It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. In the center of our service, in the center of our lives, let us make room for life's quieter sides. We may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. Please join me in a spirit of prayer. Let us not tell paltry stories about ourselves. We don't just work at a job. We have a mission that is part of the cosmic effort to improve and perfect the world. We're not just sweeping the floor, throwing out stuff, and trying to get the place cleaned up before guests arrive. We are a modern incarnation of the goddess Hestia, the one whose sacred gift is to transform a house into a homey place, to let those who enter feel cared for. We're not just doctors sewing stitches into the fourth patient to cut himself this hour. We're healing the sick, caring for them in the spirit of old Asclepius, the patron saint of physicians. We're not just taking a lawsuit to court so we can stick it to whoever we have in our sights. We are agents of fairness and social trust, working to help the powerless balance the scales of justice. We're not here just to whistle little ditties, but to sing small spiritual symphonies with our lives. We are whatever we are, so very much more than we have given ourselves credit for being. Our biggest failures are failures of imagination. We need a story worthy of us. We need the largest story that wraps us in the most imaginative tapestry of a life lived skillfully and caringly. Let us find a story worthy of our spirit and live it. Salvation can come through telling and believing the right stories about ourselves. It may be the only way it does come. Let us become spirited parts of stories that are worthy of us. Amen. Life as a work of art. What on earth does that mean? I want to begin with a quotation that Catholic theologian Pierre Teilhard de Chardin wrote over 80 years ago. Every person in the course of his life must build, starting with the natural territory of his own self, a work, an opus, into which something enters from all the elements of the earth. She makes her own soul throughout all her earthly days. And at the same time, she collaborates in another work, in another opus, which infinitely transcends, while at the same time it narrowly determines the perspectives of her individual achievement. That greater work is the completing of the world. He used the word opus for the work of a life. The word is also used for a musical composition or for an artist's total production. We are also works of art, using this metaphor. We're partly the artistic designers of our own lives, and it's the most important work we'll ever do. And boy, does that sound easier said than done. How to make a life. When most people hear this, They start by thinking of how to make a living instead, because it's the way we're trained. Some of the older folks here will remember how much this has changed in the last 50 years. In the 1950s, if you wanted to start out making a life, making a living, the object was to get a job with a good company, work for them your whole life, and they'd take care of you. You'd have health care and a good retirement. For women, the work options were severely limited. Most were steered to become nurses or teachers or stewardesses. And in the 1950s, only young women could be stewardesses, and there were no male flight attendants. For all, the goal was to get married. That's heterosexual only. Nobody was out in the 50s. To have kids, raise them to be good Americans. America was the most respected nation on earth 50 years ago. We were generous and just, trusted by almost everyone. It's amazing how much of that has changed in just 50 years. Our nation is no longer respected by many. There's little or no job security. I think I read that people entering the workforce today should expect to have 8 different jobs in 5 different fields during their career. Job benefits keep getting cut. Unions have largely been disempowered. And it's been widely reported that this generation, people in their 20s and 30s, are the first generation that cannot look forward to a higher lifestyle than their parents had, the first generation in American history. The divorce rate is about 50%, so many people have neither a job nor a partner for life. It's a lonelier time. There's a lot more competition for good schools and jobs than there was 50 years ago. School loans put people into far greater debt. 25 years ago, for example, I spent 7 years in a very expensive graduate school, and I graduated owing a total of $17,500 for 7 years. Today, Unitarian ministers leave a 3-year seminary owing between $50,000 and $80,000 or more. I've talked with at least one woman in this church getting a 4-year PhD in Latin American studies at UT who says she'll owe $100,000 for that, and it can get much worse. I have a niece who is attending medical school in Israel through a Columbia University World Medicine program. She finishes her 3rd year of medical school this year, and then she'll be getting a master's in public health from Johns Hopkins, and then doing her 4th year of medical school. When she's done, she'll owe about $300,000. She had wanted to be the next Albert Schweitzer and work in Africa. It's impossible with that kind of a loan debt. So it's harder to make a living today than it was 50 years ago. It's easy to get depressed or to get into a rant about this. But the job of making a life, as opposed to the job of making a living, really isn't fundamentally different now than it was 50 years ago. It's still a religious task, though today we use the word spiritual more than we use the word religious. And today it doesn't need to involve churches or even gods to do this. Today we stammer a lot in trying to find even a way to speak about this. Many churches still talk about this life as though it were just sort of a meaningless prelude to some life in heaven forever, if we obey a certain concept of God and a certain church. I don't believe the world is built that way. I think we do it here and now. So in many ways, that makes it even more important to try and make a good life. What is a good life? What's it mean? I don't mean anything really abstruse by it. I mean something very simple by it. I really mean a life that can let you stand in front of a mirror in 10 years or in 50 years and be able to say to the image looking back at you, if I only get one shot at this, I'm glad I've lived the way I lived. In your whole life, there is hardly anything you could say that's more important or powerful than that, or a greater judge of success. It may not be the life someone else would choose for you, but you're not supposed to live other people's lives. That's their job. You're supposed to live your own, and to some extent that means making it, crafting it, like a work of art. And while I think that's a little more complex than it used to be, it isn't fundamentally different. We need a sense that we're here for a reason, that life wants something from us, that life grants us honor and a task. Being part of a larger purpose can give meaning to our smallest acts. It makes all the difference in the world. Now, if I were an old-fashioned preacher talking in old-fashioned ways, this is where I would say, come to Jesus. Come to Jesus and be saved. I don't think a lot of people here think or talk that way. But there's something powerful about that kind of an invitation when it works. I think what it means is, recast your life as a beloved part of a larger reality, as a child of God, rather than just one more lost soul stumbling around through life. Then it can be about the larger you, precisely because it's no longer primarily about you, but about your part in a bigger story, a transcendent scheme. Then you're no longer just doing the kind of fairly menial work that we all do. Your work has now become part of the plan of the Creator of the universe. Come to Jesus and be saved. It's powerful stuff. What's right about it is that we need to be able to cast our lives as parts of a bigger and more enduring story than just making it through another day. But I think we have to try to say it in less parochial terms today. Fewer and fewer people are learning to talk about their lives as though they were about Jesus or God. The fastest growing faith groups in the country are not evangelicals, but non-believers, even atheists, who have doubled in the last 20 years to about 28 million, according to some polls. I'll talk about that more in 2 weeks when I spend a little time on this book by Christine Wicker that I mentioned earlier, her book on the fall of the evangelical nation. But no matter how we put it or what we call it, we need to call forth the image of our life as part of something greater than ourselves. And it isn't hard to do, though we're not taught how to do it. So I want to give you some examples of recasting life as part of a bigger story, putting it several different ways. One is a story that Reverend David Bumbaugh read to you 3 weeks ago, and it's a lovely story worth repeating. In the 12th century, when the great cathedrals were being built in France, a visitor went into one of these huge buildings. Over to the right were carpenters, and he said to them, "What are you doing?" They looked at him like he was an idiot, and they said, "Can't you see? We're carpenters. We're building pews." Then he went to some stonemasons. Again he asked, "What are you doing?" They laughed, and they said they were members of the Masons Guild, the finest of all the guilds. They acted like just belonging to that group meant they didn't actually need to be doing anything at all. On the other side of the room, there was a peasant woman with a broom cleaning up after the carpenters, the masons, and the rest. Of her, too, he asked, "What are you doing?" This woman stopped sweeping, stood up to her full height, and announced proudly to him, "Me? Why, I am building a magnificent cathedral to the greater glory of God." Now, we could look at her job and say, "Come on, lady. You're just sweeping the floor. You're not doing anything important. You hardly get paid anything per hour. How important could you be?" But that job gave more to her than the jobs of the carpenters and the stonemasons seemed to give to them, because she had made her life part of a much bigger story in which cleaning up was helping to build not only a magnificent cathedral, one you can still visit 800 years later, but a magnificent cathedral to the greater glory of God. It's hard to beat that. There's a simple life transformed into a work of art through an imaginative story. She had greater imagination than the carpenters and the stonemasons, and she got the rewards of the greater imagination through a transformed life. We all have simple lives, and we all need that kind of transformation. Many Hindus can still do this through their belief that the soul, the Atman, is part of the Brahman, the universal source of all energy that creates and maintains the world. And that's not just a belief, it's true. All of our lives are parts of that bigger picture, but it's so hard to see them that way. We're not taught that anymore. I think that's why come to Jesus is so appealing. It sounds so simple, so quick. No waiting in line, just bam, you're saved. We love that. I often envy the ancient Greeks who knew that these spirits were eternal and turned most of them into gods. And so craftspeople and artists weren't just making pews or doing stonework. They were serving the gods of art, music, and beauty. Hephaestus, Apollo, Athena. They were doing sacred duty in their work. Parents planted seeds of tomorrow and nurtured them as part of the creative force of the universe. And that's not just poetry. That's biological fact. They were the current incarnations of the spirits of Zeus, Hera, and Demeter. And they knew it. How dignified that is. Homemakers, those with the gifts for making a house feel like a home, or making a church service feel like a worship service, were serving that invisible goddess Hestia, the only one who was never painted or sculpted, the goddess of that feeling of being deeply at home. Thinkers weren't just ivory tower eggheads or over-educated intellectuals. Look how we describe ourselves today, how demeaning it is. Thinkers were those who helped bring fire, helped bring light into the darkness. They were modern incarnations of Prometheus. Soldiers weren't just murdering foreigners. They were serving the dangerous but sometimes necessary god Ares. Even politics could be transformed by casting it this way. Even modern politics could be transformed by casting it this way. A Hillary Clinton could be recognized as the spirit of the goddesses Artemis and Athena. And Obama could be seen in the role of Hermes, that messenger from the gods who carried the message beyond comfortable boundaries because the message was more holy than the boundaries. Look how transformative that is. Heraclitus once said that everything is filled with gods, and in his world it was. You didn't have to come to Jesus. You didn't have to go anywhere, because the gods were everywhere. You just had to understand your gifts and your passions as on loan from the gods, as callings, as duties, as a sacred task, because They are. Look how this could transform human lives. All it's doing is changing a story. It still can. I think of a modern Greek, a modern cosmopolitan international Greek, Arianna Huffington. Was born in Athens, lived there till she was 16, was then educated at Cambridge, and now lives in this country. The ancient Greek gods still help frame her life. She wrote that as an ambitious single mother of two daughters, she saw her life as a constant dialogue between the demands of Artemis and Demeter. Now, how much more dignifying and also descriptive that is than just calling her an ambitious single working mother with two girls? It's so much easier to view our life as a work of art when we think of ourselves as incarnating eternal spirits, and we do incarnate them. But today our spiritual vocabulary is so sparse we hardly know how to talk about it. We're just trying to get through the day, you know, doing our job, trying to get a fair deal, trying to get the best deal we can make. All this kind of talk is the way we describe ourselves today. It has no magic. It has no myth. It has no power. Talking about gods leaves many people cold, even the ancient Greek gods. It sounds so otherworldly in all the wrong ways. So let me share part of my own story with you, two of my own come-to-Jesus moments that transformed how I defined myself and my job as a minister and as your minister. I've told parts of this before, but I'm not doing it to talk about myself. I'm doing it to offer you more ways to talk about yourselves. I went to one of those elite graduate schools. I worked as hard as everybody else there did and earned master's and PhD degrees. I saw it as a pretty solitary adventure, the adventure of a hermit. You go to seminars, you read, then you read some more, then you discuss, and you read, you write, and eventually you graduate. That's about it. Graduation ceremonies have never meant much to me. They've just seemed terribly phony, and I've avoided them. But a classmate there told me that I had to go to the ceremony to get my PhD. I said, no, I don't. They can mail it. And he said, you don't understand. He said, you have to be there to hear what President Gray says to all the PhD students. Now, Hannah Gray, who was then the president of the University of Chicago, was the first woman president of what they called any elite university. I admired her, and I was on a committee with her. I knew her a little bit. But come on, commencement addresses? They're like political speeches. They're all predictable rhetoric, no significant substance. My classmate assured me I was wrong, and I trusted him, so I bought the cap, rented the gown, and went. I can still feel that day. It was a come to Jesus moment that absolutely took me by surprise and transformed my life. Who would have believed it? When the other degrees had been awarded, she called the doctoral students forward, and she said those magical words, which were burned into my memory instantly, and I've talked to other graduates of that school who can remember exactly the same words from years different from mine. It's just a come-to-Jesus moment for almost everybody who goes through it there, it seems. What she said was very simple. She said, I welcome you into the ancient and honorable community of scholars. That's it. It was transformative. suddenly, as quick as come to Jesus, suddenly, we were no longer just a few more graduate students hiding out in libraries, working on papers and dissertations nobody but our three readers would ever want to read. Now, we were part of something grand, an ancient and honorable community of scholars of which I hadn't even been aware until then. Plato, Aristotle, and us. You try not to dwell too long on that Plato-Aristotle business, or the magic wears off and it just feels really, really embarrassing. But for the first time, I believed I was part of an ancient tradition of millions of people who had been so curious and passionate about something that we wanted to devote years to its study and lives to its service. And suddenly, through just those few words, that was all transformed into something mythic and sacred and commanding. It was amazing. My other come-to-Jesus moment, not that powerful, but powerful, had happened a few years earlier during some of that reading. I read a book by a very influential 20th century conservative theologian, Karl Barth, where he was addressing a group of young ministers. David Bumbaugh and I talked about this when he was here 3 weeks ago, and he said he also memorized this same line the first time he read it 40 years ago, and it had been his sacred commandment since then as it's been mine. What the theologian has said to this group of young ministers was also very simple. He said this. He said, "Your people expect you to take them more seriously than they take themselves, and they will not think kindly of you if you fail to do so." Come to Jesus. I think of this every Sunday. I think of this every week when I'm preparing a sermon. It isn't about me. It's about this ancient and honorable community. It's about a sacred duty to take people perhaps even more seriously than they want to take themselves. In my mind, those ancient and honorable people are watching me. I can feel their eyes. That's not always a good thing. And I don't always succeed at this, as you know. Nobody does. But those two statements transformed my life from the life of a single, fairly unimportant Unitarian minister to someone who feels empowered and commanded by an ancient tradition far larger and more enduring than I will ever be. It's the same feelings as coming to Jesus, but without the Jesus. Now, this isn't your story, so you may say, or at least be sitting there thinking, "Oh, come off it. You're just a preacher at a church most people in Austin have never heard of, preaching to fewer than 0.1% of the population. Come off it. There's nothing about this that's very important." Now, most of that's true, too. Just as it's true that the peasant woman was really only sweeping the floor, or that Arianna Huffington is just a driven woman with two kids. But these larger callings, whether her seeing herself as incarnations of Artemis and Demeter, or my believing I'm part of an ancient and honorable community of scholars charged with helping people take themselves more seriously, these larger callings transform solitary lives into little works of art because they reconnect us with those enduring, perhaps eternal spirits that all of us are part of. And what about you? That's what this is really about. How would you describe your life? Would you describe your life in ways that make you seem isolated and small? or in ways that connect you with a life force that transcends, empowers, and blesses you? Are you just insignificant little you? Or are you one of the masks of God? An incarnation of Holy Spirit's, a small but significant part of a cause, a belief, an ideal that is timeless and incredibly important to the world. And part of your job is to help bring it here. Are you sweeping the floor or building a magnificent cathedral to the greater glory of God? Putting a few bucks in the collection plate, as we'll do in a few minutes, or helping to plant trees and reclaim some of the lost beauty of Mother Earth right here in Austin. It's your choice. I'd like you to discuss these things this week with your friends, your family, somewhere you can feel safe and won't get put down for dreaming. You can choose the story of which your life is a part, whether small or large, and that choice makes all the difference in recasting your life as a work of art. And so, what about you, as happens so often in this church? It's your move.